Welcome back to the Film 89 podcast. This is episode 113, and tonight I'm joined once again by possibly the most frequently returning of all of Film 89's many guest hosts to give our spoiler-filled review, analysis, and verdict of part two of Denis Villeneuve's epic adaptation of Frank Herbert's seminal science fiction novel, Dune. That man, aside from bearing an uncanny similarity to Baron Harkonnen, is as big a fan of Dune as you're likely to find. In particular, a fan of David Lynch's 1984 film version of Dune, a film that he and I discussed back in the latter half of 2021 on episode 72, when we discussed both 1984's Dune and part one of Villeneuve's new adaptation of Dune. That man is, of course, Mr. Bill Scurry. Bill, welcome back.
He who can podcast about a thing controls a thing.
And I said the days of me giving you long-winded introductions were over.
Yeah, that ended a few podcasts ago, I think.
Now, Bill, you've already done a fairly concise Dune Part 2 live stream with James Hancock. That the first half was kind of spoiler-free. The second half, you kind of blew the lid off and went full-on spoiler attack on James Hancock's YouTube channel. And in order not to replicate the format of that discussion and to sort of give something of a nice companion piece, and also to change the structure of our regular discussions on Film 89, a nice little way to tackle this is, instead of our usual format of reviewing the film, I'm going to hit you up with a series of questions in relation to the film and your feelings about it. I've not given you any prep for this, Bill. I've not sent you any questions, is that right?
None whatsoever.
So you're going in blind.
Blind.
But given how much of a huge Dune aficionado you are, I know you're up for the task.
Yeah.
So, first things first, Bill. This is a film you've been waiting for. Eagerly anticipated would be an understatement, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even beyond just the last two movie cycles. But yeah, long time in my life.
84, Dune, David Lynch's film. That is one of your all-time favorite films. I think you've, apart from, the Dune episode we've done, you've done numerous live streams with James Hancock about Dune over the last couple of years. You are one of the champions of 84 Dune.
Yeah, my mistresses are tired of me talking about it.
So, first off then, Bill, given how considerably lofty your expectations were for this second part of Villeneuve's Dune adaptation, has this second film lived up to those expectations?
Yeah, and not only that, I think I made a prediction when I wrote my review in the first case saying that there was almost no way Villeneuve was going to bobble this ball and not get a perfect five-star review out of this. Such was my faith in this guy based on everything I'd seen, even though I'm not the hugest fan of his oeuvre. I think that he completely nailed the first part, and I thought, and correctly I assumed, that it was essentially a lot of throat clearing, which would completely clear the skids for a part two, which absolutely banged. And I don't, so far, I have yet to read any reviews that aren't bolstering my prognostication, my faith in this man, that he was going to nail the part two of it. And, you talk about waiting a long time in my life for this. To see, for instance, our common friend James Hancock, I think, did at least four videos on Dune Part Two, two of which were box office predictions, one of which was a review, and one was the live stream that we did. But there's a moment in popular culture where nearly every other movie culture outlet is talking about this, not just as a report of the weekend, but also as a phenomenon, talking about this as this thing that people just make the most obliquest references to Dune 1984 and are more talking about this as closer to an Oppenheimer-type phenomenon of like nutritious vegetables for the audience to eat that wind up selling in profuse amounts. This is not something I expected to happen from this, but I'm glad I'm here for it.
Yeah, no, the part one, Bill, that's well over 2.5 years ago, isn't it? Wasn't it October 2021?
Yeah, that was marred by pandemic. It was all sorts of weird, goofy bullshit that kind of like probably tamped down the numbers, but yet did not, dim the expectations nor the reaction when it finally landed. I mean, it didn't make as much money as it otherwise would have, but it was pretty sharp.
Yeah, but outside of our own sort of purview, was it the first film anywhere near as big an event as this second one has already proven to be, both in the build-up to its release and, we're now still within week one of its global release, and discussion on film Twitter is primarily about this film at the moment, much like last year when the Barbenheimer phenomenon struck. Everything was about that. It seems like we've come to the 1st of March 2024 and this thing has just exploded And
yeah.
It doesn't seem in keeping with my recollection of how popular the first film was. And that's no smite on the first film. The first film is a film that I really enjoyed. I think I gave it, you know, in the episode you and I did, I gave it 8 out of 10. On the subsequent rewatch, not too long ago, that went up to a solid 9 out of 10. I really, really enjoyed it a hell of a lot more second time round. And, well, I'll come to that later, but this one just seems to have, I don't know, it's just hit something. I don't know if it's because of the current state of cinema and the fact that in the wake of the strikes that hit Hollywood last year, people are maybe seeing or expecting a kind of fallow period now. And, you know, this is sort of, it certainly is for me, this is the big film of 2024 I've been looking forward to. As I said to, you know, I commented to you and James on your live stream the other night, this is kind of like the only film I'm looking forward to in 2024. There's not really anything else.
Yeah, actually, you're correct about that. As much as I know Deadpool's going to strike this year, I wouldn't exactly say I'm looking forward to Deadpool. You know, I'm sure something else coming down the pike. But yeah, there is a discussion about this, a crossover talk that people are looking at it in such a way as to kind of validate the idea of making a movie for grown-ups that has not just a long runtime, but a lot of characters, a lot of dense, hard school, old school sci-fi, an adaptation of a book on top of everything else. But also this morning, I see that there is this video going. It was, I think, a TikTok that was going viral of a dude dressed up full Fremen in a movie lobby, I'm sure somewhere in America, where he like turned a scooter into a Shai Hulud, and he's actually zipping through the lobby carpet of an American film theater dressed as a Fremen riding a worm. And it's like, I'll be goddamned if anybody knew that this kind of thing was going to happen, that it was going to sort of turn into a pop sensation. Especially something that was hard sci-fi like this.
Yeah. And of course, then we saw in that tweet I shared with you today that Zendaya appeared on some show and she's wearing a black t-shirt with the poster image from 1984's Dune on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but that makes sense because, you know, Zendaya is styled out to the nines. She's got a good team behind her. And before this, I think when they did the English premiere or the French premiere, she was wearing something akin to the a C-3PO outfit.
Yeah.
It was a strange, like Fritz Lang Metropolis robot with a lot of transparent carapaces and whatnot. And granted, she's built enough to do this and she's fashion forward. It was like an original Thierry Mugler, Mugler piece, however you want to pronounce it. But yeah, the fact that she shows up in the, in the interview wearing something like a band t-shirt as if it was Guns N' Roses or a Motley Crue, I think it's good messaging. It's you know, it's little, says a little something about the history of people are paying attention to what came before.
Well, you know, do you think as well, Bill, the reason this struck so hard and so successfully in such a short period of time is because, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to think back of the last big thing in terms of cinema. I can't think of anything since Barbenheimer, which was, what was that, August last year?
Something like that, exactly.
Yeah, you know, what have we had since? There was no big Christmas release. We've had, you know, failures, you know, numerous failures from Disney in terms of both animation, superhero stuff. Crikey, Star Wars is pretty much dead in the water. There's been no big Christmas franchise this year, which, you know, again, we haven't had for quite a long time now. Like back in the days of when we used to have a Lord of the Rings film, a Harry Potter film, you know, a big Disney Pixar film release. We've had no event movies. So for this thing to come along, I think it's struck at the right time when people are just hungry. And I think also especially hungry for a film that I think just quite subtly rejects all of the crap that has been poisoning Hollywood films of the last, near enough, kind of close to the last decade now. It sort of jettisoned all of that in favor of just solid, precise filmmaking, free of any silly Californian Hollywood ideology, and it just wants to tell a good story whilst also being, in terms of its cast, wholly inclusive and wide ranging. You've got people from all different backgrounds in this huge international cast. But again, that is just one of the facets of the film. That is not a forced selling point of the film.
It's one of those things that that's reminiscent of the way they used to make these kind of movies, where, you know, one of the greatest comps is looking at Dune 84 and seeing that it is very much composed like this movie, where you had a mixture of guys like Richard Jordan and Jürgen Prochnow and Max von Sydow and Linda Hunt, who had just won an Oscar shortly before making Dune 1984, Kyle MacLachlan, who was a fresh face find. Dean Stockwell, you know, who was a child actor and a guy who had had a steady, continued presence in movies in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And, you know, to make a movie like that today, it would need to look like this, stacked with this kind of, not just the level of talent, but all the various places where you get a guy like Josh Brolin, who was in the fucking Goonies. Austin Butler, you know, who was Elvis a year and a half or 2 years ago. Dave Bautista, who was like bending guys, breaking their backs over his kneecap like a decade and a half ago. There's just a strange mix of actors in here that you would have never expected to see in one place. And I think of, you know, the inclusion of, in particular, Walken and Charlotte Rampling. Those two actors make me think of like 1980. You know, Walken was in like Days of Heaven. Charlotte Rampling is with Paul Newman in The Verdict. Talk about the history of people in this movie who would not otherwise have been in other movies. Could I see Rise of Skywalker pulling an Isabel Huppert or something like that? I don't know. You know, I mean, it's you know, one thing to say you can make a giant budget feature with a guy like Michael Caine and Clive Owen in it, but it's another thing to like get this like cock of the walk class of their generation actors to come together for a movie like this, which has, again, great bones, a lot of great vegetable nutrition, and, you know, something for everybody.
Yeah, the cast is absolutely phenomenal. And also, I think maybe there's just one aspect of his success is probably because the last 15 years of cinema has been pretty much dominated by the superhero genre. And I think it's safe to say now, given recent failures, that that bubble has certainly burst. And given the most recent catastrophe, Madame Web, which has just become something of a, you know, a laughing stock, and it, so much so that even the cast members are kind of subtly acknowledging the fact that the film is just not very good. I think just audiences are hungry for something different, and this kind of ticks all the boxes. It's big, epic spectacle. It's awesome action. It's got an incredible cast. It's got all of those things that not too long ago the superhero genre was given, but now is completely devoid of. Is there a huge Dune fan base there that is accounting for the success of this film? I don't think there is. I think Dune is still, in terms of, you know, it being a sort of hardcore sci-fi intellectual piece, I still think it's fairly niche. It's not something that, in inverted commas, the normies would tend to go for, but I think it's the timing of this as well, something which accounts for the fact that this film already seems to be so much more successful than the first film, which, yes, that did come very much in the wake of COVID, that had all of that to deal with, but this film now being free of that, it's just allowed to bloom and flourish, as hopefully it will, and hopefully go on to huge box office success.
Yeah, and I was just listening to a discussion today that we're talking about if this movie had sort of adhered to the original box office drop, I believe it would have showed up in late October, early November. It was supposed to be a kind of like pre-run-up to Christmas, end of the year type Oscar movie. And I mean, I'll be goddamned if that would not have gummed up the works of the Academy Award machine, if you were to think about it. I mean, what would it have pushed out? There would have been a couple of movies, maybe Anatomy of the Fall would not have gotten in. I don't know. It's hard to say exactly. If you put this in, this competes with Oppenheimer. This is a Denis Villeneuve fight, a slugfest at the top with Christopher Nolan. Now, as it is, this comes out now in this sort of moribund, right after dumpuary, which is a term I just, you know, heard in the popular parlance in the last month. The nice thing is that Villeneuve and Christopher Nolan, because Nolan has been doing the Oscar run-up with all these sort of like really gregarious podcast appearances that, you know, I've never heard this guy laugh before or sound vaguely human. He gets to talk about Villeneuve very much as a friendly competitor that is adding to the movie rather than taking away from his angle of the business. They don't have to fight for an award. They get to gaud each other up. And the same thing, Villeneuve is talking about Nolan's movie very salutarily and saying that, you know, everything is great, that these can exist at the same time because they're not slugging it out. And so it's this strange environment where, for the moment, you get the, like, Oscars, we're talking about Oscar voting closed last week, and the Oscars are going to be in just, like, a short period of time. So it's this weird gap between, well, this isn't in competition, so we get the draft, all those beautiful fumes of people still talking about Paul Giamatti and how wonderful Oppenheimer is and the presumptive Oscars for Robert Downey Jr., and this, which is hopefully still going to be on people's minds when it comes time for the next Oscar cycle. And like, there's a good smell in the air in terms of good, nutritious film. I keep saying the word nutritious, but it's a cliche, but it works. that you have the best of last year is still lingering as a miasma in the atmosphere. And this comes out, which sort of like galvanizes people saying, Jesus, not only could a real complicated movie with a lot of story beats and dense storytelling, which only, you know, spoiler, it winds up being part two of a three-part saga, and it doesn't really advertise that, but is the truth. There's more to come. It does augur well for good filmmaking. And again, if these guys at the top of the food pyramid, guys like Nolan and Villeneuve, can handshake with each other, I mean, I'd rather see that moment cast, the sort of post-pandemic, post-Tenet moment where Tenet, you know, gets relegated to nothing. And it's a good film, but it's not quite the meal that Oppenheimer is. You know, but again, this is the sort of thing you want to see people like. You know, this does mean something that they like it in the kind of quantity that they do like it today.
Yeah, you know, the whole Barbenheimer phenomenon, which, you know, even when myself and Matthias were trying to get our heads around how it actually became a thing, bearing in mind it seems to be born of something outside of someone in a marketing department saying, hey, there's a fit, you know, there's a natural fit between these two films, which clearly there wasn't. I think that was part of the attraction. This phenomenon kind of grew out of some genius's idea on social media that put the two together, and it went from there, and both films benefited. I certainly think that Oppenheimer benefited more from that phenomenon. Both films totally different for many different reasons, but neither of them, I would say, fell into that sort of mold of a cookie cutter type film that we have been force fed for the, you know, since God knows when, franchise film. Even though, yes, Barbie, you could argue it's not a franchise film because it's not part of an existing film franchise. It's just an adaptation of a children's toy line. And an Oppenheimer has got no such connections. It's a, you know, historical biopic. But, you know, I think these two films were so successful because they weren't what everyone has been force-fed these last couple of years. And I think Dune Part 2, not having the same shackles that the first one did in terms of when it was released and the state of cinema at the time, I'm hopeful now that this film's success will kickstart a lot of studios into thinking, yeah, let's have a look at our slate. Let's look at the stuff which is following on from just doing what everyone else is doing, doing what Marvel is doing what Warner Brothers are doing with their DC stuff. Let's just wipe the slate. Let's get some original IP. And let's go back to filmmaking before we fell into this rut and before Hollywood fell into this rut. Because I just think that Dune Part 2 is a film that is just elevated above the muck that we've had, you know, the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I would say that not only that, but Villeneuve, who I've already been a fan of, I thought Sicario is just an incredible film, a sort of statement of genius from a guy who's crossing over from doing his own, you know, his own bit of independent filmmaking to something more studio related. I like Blade Runner 2049, but it doesn't quite hold. Like, it's even today, I believe it looks even creakier as a piece of like legacy IP based on something great that we love compared to Dune and Dune Part 2. It is in itself a good movie, but it has a lot of flaws that he seems to have corrected. It's like he puts his whole repertoire together to becoming someone who may well be one of the most versatile, like Swiss Army knives that you have working in large budget tapestry movies today. And not only that, but there's this ridiculous conversation I hear online, people talking about how this movie, Dune Part 2, budgeted at, what was it, 190? People saying it's like, how did they get this movie to look so good with such a modest budget, as if in some ways a movie made between $150 and $200 million is in any way, shape, or form a modestly budgeted movie. I mean, I'll leave it up to him. Villeneuve, in fact, did make all the money appear on the screen. But in some ways, people want there to be a divide between $300 million moribund franchises that look terrible and a movie made for, I don't know, $180 million, which looks absolutely stellar.
Maybe look at the big enigma of 2023 that came out just at the very tail end that wasn't a film from the Hollywood system. It was a film from outside of it. It was a film from Japan. Godzilla Minus One. Film that I think the most accurate reported figure as to that film's budget now is currently sitting around about the $13 million mark. And
Jesus Christ.
The final film that we saw looks... that would have cost Hollywood a similar fee to what this film cost.
Yeah.
And clearly there's a question to be asked there as to how Godzilla Minus One was made for $13 million and looked as epic and great as it did. You know, for me personally, it is my favourite film of 2023. And then Hollywood needs to be seriously asking questions of itself. But I think this second Dune film, for $190 million, it looks like, in current Hollywood budgetary terms, given what we've seen of late, what we've seen in the last 5, 10, 15 years, it looks like it cost about $500 million.
Yeah, Yeah, it's as if David Lean had access to all the tools, all the panel. I mean, that's obviously the Laurence Olivier, Laurence of Arabia, now Laurence Olivier, influences around this movie sleeve. And if a guy like Lean could somehow make a movie with all these tools at his disposal, I have no doubt that it would look something closer to this than it would Morbius or Madame Web or something with really shoddy CGI, facial replacements, you know, Dial of Destiny type chicanery. I don't think you would have seen that.
Yeah, I think the reason that they've got so much sort of on-screen value for money is the fact that I think this film has been more carefully crafted in terms of planning, pre-visualization. They've not just done the thing that we've seen or heard of with Hollywood studios lately, where they've just been battering effects houses, getting them to redo effect shots, go over things, do, you know, maybe five or six different versions of a scene, and therefore wasting millions of dollars. This has been meticulously crafted, properly planned out, and Villeneuve and co. have stuck with that plan. Therefore, they've saved millions of dollars, and every dollar spent on this film has been spent more carefully and wisely, back like films used to be made. There was a far tighter grip on budgets, and God knows what sort of costs are not even being mentioned in films these days. Someone has to start accounting for the fact that these films, which are costing $300 million, films like The Marvels, are just not looking anywhere near as good as, you know, a film like this, $190 million. And like I say, it genuinely does look like it cost $500 million. This film is 2 hours and 46 minutes, and at no point do I feel as if the bubble has burst and I'm pulled out of the film and I'm thinking, yeah, that looks like a sound stage, that looks like a green screen. It just completely immersed me in this world that Villeneuve had created, and at no point did the veil slip, and I was just sucked in for the duration of the film.
You know what you saying that makes me think of, the like the Marvels, for instance, was made in the Copacabana from Goodfellas, where the liquor was coming in the front door and it's going out of the back door. Yeah. in the same shot, where it's essentially is being busted out. You know, somebody is making a lot of money about this movie. You know, it's not the director, and it's not the, certainly the viewer is not seeing any of the money. No. Go on the screen, because somebody is taking the studio for a larcenous run at the same time. But let's not also underestimate the effect of location shooting. This is not volume shooting. This is not green screen. This is not for as much as there was done in a Budapest soundstage, there's a lot of photography on like Wadi Rum in Jordan, and in I think it was somewhere in the Emirates, I believe. It was outside like Abu Dhabi. They were shooting a lot of the stuff in the dust. I mean, the scene where Chalamet and Zendaya are sitting on top of a dune before they kiss, you know, like talk about giving you that like Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago shot of like sealing the deal, all the stuff that David Lynch did not do in the first movie, the first version of the movie, I should say, where he's trying to cement the fact that Chani and Paul Atreides have a bond, using the sunlight at the right magical hour and doing a swirling camera shot around them sitting on the top of the crest of a dune. I mean, that's old school David Lean filmmaking. That's not the kind of thing they do anymore. And you tell me that sort of thing doesn't sell, that people can't, on some level, their antennae aren't pricked up by the fact that you're watching human beings in the middle of a vast landscape that is what it purports to be, rather than pixelated screens that show you stormtroopers inside of a marketplace somewhere. I mean, give me a break.
Well, you've basically answered my third question here, which would have been, Villeneuve said that he was influenced by David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia. Aside from the obvious similarity of the desert setting, do you see any of Lean's legendary historical epic coming through in this second Dune film? I think I know what your answer is going to be.
But wait, I got another one for you too, because and I upon further consideration, I thought of this. How much does Bardem look like Tony Quinn?
Yes.
I mean, I know that Tony Quinn had sort of a smear nose on. They gave him a little. Yeah. They darkened his face up. He was, you know, what was he? A Mexican actor, grew up in America, like Mexican American generally, but played a shitload of. Man, I've seen him. He played North African. He played Turkish. He played Balkan. He played just about every ethnicity. Like that's what they used to do in the old days. And Jose Ferrer, to some degree, also played the same roles. Bardem, when he's crouching in a steel suit and he's got the sort of schmutz all over his face. Yeah, he looks a lot like, in a good way, he's heralding back to Tony Quinn, a classic actor who's absolutely incredible in, you know, in Lawrence of Arabia. That's just one nod, and I don't know if it's, can't quite be intentional, unintentional. It must be, in fact, part of it must be intentional because it looks like such a one-to-one to me.
There definitely is a resemblance between the two.
Yeah.
You know, the lean question being my third, let's go back to my second question. You mentioned the amazing cast in this film. Who were the standout performances for you this time around in this second film?
I think Chalamet had, as much as he was like the centerpiece of the first movie and he was undergoing a kind of like personal journey through his mentors to some degree, a lot of the set pieces of that movie were him tracking through the various father figures along the way. He had a lot to prove in terms of bulking up his performance. And I thought for sure that he would do a thing where he either lost weight or put weight on to change his body type. But he really didn't do that. And for a small, tiny little man, he was shot differently and he added a lot of intensity, tracked dramaturgically what his character would be going through. And so when he boomed, when his voice boomed, it wasn't the gigantic stentorian howl of a leading man like Marlon Brando or something like that, but he got the job done. I sort of didn't notice that this was a tiny little actor in human life sounding big on screen. He really sold me the idea that his voice was the voice of the Mahdi, a messiah, a human being who was like putting this idea over to all these Fremen in a cave, that he was their leader. So that was the first thing that needed to happen. But Austin Butler, who I have not been a giant fan for because I think he's mostly untested. I refuse to go see the Elvis Presley movie just because I'm not a big Baz Luhrmann guy. So he had less to do in my brain. Like the character of Fate occupied more real estate than Austin Butler did. However, his weirdness, the idea that he was doing a kind of replicated growl of Stellan Skarsgård's like Swedish grumble was really effective. It told me that this guy maybe comes up with his characters from the voice outwards and kind of built this like skin-headed, weird knife-wielding freak from the idea of imitating Stellan Skarsgård, which was not a bad decision in retrospect, too.
Yeah, that imitation of Skarsgård, I don't know if he needed to go as hard as he did on that. That's just a personal preference. I think his performance was superb. He was really creepy, sinister, sadistic. I thought he was great in the Elvis film, but I've not seen him in anything else, but I think he was great. I think there are some characters who were a little bit underused and a little bit, I think they were a little shortchanged, but on the whole, I don't think there's a deaf performance in the film.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
I think Chalamet really comes into his own. He really does. And I didn't have any particular issues with him in the first film, but in this film, he gives a commanding lead performance. I thought Zendaya was just awesome. Rebecca Ferguson, not that I've ever seen her bad in anything, is just phenomenal in this. Yeah. I thought Javier Bardem was just possibly my favourite character in the film. I thought Brolin, you know, delivered the goods. And then the more minor roles, Princess Irulan, Florence Pugh, she was great. I don't know if they made the best use of Walken, I've got to be honest.
I can see where you're going with that, but I also think that Walken has not been, I mean, he has been working continuously, but not in stuff we've seen. It's weird. I had this conversation with our common friend, Matthias van der Roos, where we were looking back at IMDb to see that he's done series work. I think he's either been on Apple TV shows or Hulu shows, stuff that, you know, just completely, you know, we've spaced on. But I don't think he's been given serious roles, the kind of, you know, the likes of which that we used to know him for, things like, you know, the King of New York. I saw a little bits and pieces of Walken accessing some muscles that he didn't really use in a good long time in between doing comedies and doing like throwaway stuff. I like the fact that it was such a gigantic monster like Walken using so little of his ability. It's almost like when Keanu Reeves as Neo was able to start parrying with Agent Smith with one arm. It's like, well, you know, we don't need to use the whole thing because he's just such a wizard and you're just expecting this one thing. I think that's kind of the reason why they put Walken in simple, like gray silver robes and not a huge, you know, regalement of a king. It's like they were trying to undersell a little bit who this man is. They allowed the people around him to sort of confer this imperial nobility on him. And for me, it worked. I guess not for everybody, though.
Yeah, I don't think I was sold on that imperial nobility, and I don't think that I took him as a character that sold to me that he was the guy in charge of the universe. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that Jose Ferrer outwardly did anything differently in the 84 film, but I didn't feel that about him. I felt there was an aloofness and a sort of high and mighty presence about him that kind of sold more to me the fact that he was a better fit for the character of the Emperor than Walken was in this film.
Yeah.
I got to say it, you know, one of my criticisms of the first film was the fact that I was making comparisons to Baron Harkonnen from this modern iteration to the 84 one, and this one wasn't coming off too good. And I don't think that improved greatly in the second film.
Well, I'll go with you on that one, and I don't think that's a fault of Skarsgård or the design of the movie. I don't think it's a bad thing to say. It merely, for me, heightens the praise for what Kenny McMillan did working for Lynch back in 84. I think that the Baron, the creation, the invention of the Baron, this device that they created with the fat suit and the bare feet and the sweat and the skin disease and all of the practical effects, the wonderful love and care they put into what they did in 84 with the Baron is a completely different invention than the sort of gigantic, huge, but still sanitary, smooth, dry, well, I guess oil-covered version of the Baron smoking and sitting in his giant wheelchair with the liquid, the lungs breathing for him, tethered above to him by, like, anti-gravity devices. But, you know, that, to me, gets into a little bit of the only criticism I would have on Denis Villeneuve's version of Dune compared to 1984 Dune. And really, Kenneth McMillan is like the fault line of that, just simply because of how unrestrained Kenneth McMillan was, how libidinal, how body horror, every single thing that man did speaks to the virtue of the great things of Dune 1984. And Stellan Skarsgård was giving you completely different energy and a completely different inspiration for his version of the Baron Harkonnen today.
Yeah, yeah. I also think that Dave Bautista as the Beast Raban, I think he kind of got a short shrift in this. When he does have that sort of final confrontation with Gurney Halleck, that fight was just over way too quickly.
Yeah, very quickly.
And yeah. I don't know if it's anything to do with Villeneuve's handling of combat. Maybe he's just not particularly adept at it. But, you know, he did then show later on in the fight with Fade Rauther and Paul that he is capable of that. And yeah. In the film, this 2 hours and 46 minutes, I it seems that when the Beast met his fate and the Baron met his, obviously the Baron's been different to how it was portrayed in the 84 film and the book. I just think it was over too quickly and it was very anticlimactic. And given how vile and sadistic and horrible these characters are supposed to be, and you know we've actually seen them be on screen, I certainly think the second film really does push the PG-13 boundaries to near the limit. I just wanted something a little bit more satisfying.
Yeah, I wanted something more grisly, to be fair.
Yeah,
You know, and there were some scenes in Sicario. Actually, there's a bunch of scenes in Sicario. And it's one of the reasons why that sticks out to me in my mind is because the house on the border that's...
The bodies in the drywall.
Holy balls, mm-hmm. Man. I mean, it's a mixture between that, the idea of, like, that's something out of a Resident Evil movie, and then the very ending in that movie with, you know, Benio del Toro at the dinner with the family, just executing them one by one as they eat dinner. You know, there's something, he didn't pull any punches there. And, you know, that's to me is the fully unrestrained Villeneuve that I'm not sure he was really cautioned to pull back as much. I almost got the impression that he found a way to do this that was more sanitized for him, for his own sake. I don't think his incisors were ground down, or, you know, I don't think his sort of, he was defanged. It seems to me that this is really more of a cleaner, smoother edged, much like every single spaceship surface and or architectural building looks like solid granite that has a smooth surface, almost like plain stone without filigree. And in the David Lynch version, there is a lot of intricate woodworking. And like, for instance, in the Emperor's Palace, in Caladan, in the common areas of Arakeen, you know, you see a lot of filigree detail that you can tell that this is something that craftsmen worked over to create a billion whorls and, you know, just like Rococo details everywhere. And this was supposed to be a future that was more based on plain surfaces, cold, you know, chiseled granite, you know, right angles, orthogonal design and things like that. So if you start chopping off people's heads and, you know, bisecting their bodies and having torture, and the one bit of unrestrained access this had to that sort of like David Cronenberg type filmmaking to me was the scene where they're desiccating the Harkonnen bodies with these sort of like ersatz dehydrators. They're just essentially stabbing them to their chest and stealing their water right at the beginning of the movie. And it's like, oh, you're watching them like drain these dudes and almost like turn them into human prunes out there. And it's like, yeah, of course they're going to steal their, they're not thinking anything of it. The Fremen are just taking their water. And it is up to Lady Jessica to sit there and gag and dry heave over what was happening. It's like, oh Jesus, I guess this is just the reality that we're in. Human life has no measure, and we're just going to steal the water for the bodies. I wish there had been more of that. You know, David Lynch had his movie filled with skin diseases and cats that needed to be milked, you know, just all sorts of weird ass bullshit. You know, heart plugs was a perfect example of something that wasn't in the book, but it winds up being such, you know, a great detail, a great curlicue of whatever disgustingness that David Lynch has with the human body. Again, bordering on David Cronenberg. And it wasn't in this movie. I wish it was, but I do think it was intense. I don't think it's a bug. I think it's a feature of Villeneuve thinking this big.
Yeah, yeah. So there are some obvious omissions of things in the book in Villeneuve's adaptation. Which ones, if any, do you think, by way of their omission, hinder or otherwise hamper the story being told here?
Well, the one that always struck me was that the first, this is a spoiler for a book that's something like 60 years old, the fact that there is a baby involved in Dune that gets killed in an early raid by the Sadakar, that doesn't bother me. That doesn't show up in any of these things. I mean, it is an omission, the fact that there's a first Leto 2 before the second Leto 2 comes in Dune Messiah at the very end when they give birth. I think that... you know, to go this far and to be faced with the choices that Villeneuve had to make in terms of Alia, where you could either go the David Lynch version where he had a precocious child actor. And I mean, there's actually some great passages. If the listener wants to go back and read Max Every's book, The Complete Oral History of Dune, which just came out towards the end of the year, he's got extensive interviews with Alicia Witt about what it was like to shoot that movie and the casting process. You know, it's one of a kind. I should say what happened to her as a child actor from Worcester, Massachusetts. It's one of a kind. And, you know, people don't cast in movies like that. But, you know, the idea being they cast this actor who was able to mimic the dialogue and read the lines, but they voiced her over later on in a very weird choice, creation. It doesn't sound anything like a real human being. It makes an otherworldly movie feel more otherworldly. So the question is, it's like, well, does Denis Villeneuve want to get a child actor in here? Do they want to get a small adult actor to play the role? Or do they want to CGI a character? I think the best thing that he could have possibly come up with was sort of like a talking fetus with a dream sequence. But, you know, I don't know. How did you feel about Alia in this movie?
Obviously, you know, throughout this film, she is a developing fetus, isn't she?
Yeah.
Now, I'll come clean, Bill. I've still not read the book. Hadn't read the book back when we recorded in 2021, and I've still not read it. But I'm at a point now where I'm ready to read the book, finally.
But I mean, I feel like you might as well have read the book. You know what I'm saying? It's like you get all the pieces.
Yeah.
It's all there.
I think it's one of the big changes which may upset hardcore fans of the book. I think they did it in terms of, or the reason it was done is because of the time frame the film was looking to be set within. And again, is it clear how much time passes between the start of this film and the end? I don't think we're given any sort of frame of reference in terms of time.
Yeah, well, you would have to, you're describing, I would say, under 7 or 8 months, considering that she was pregnant close from the start of Dune 1.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, Lady Jessica has not delivered her baby even towards the end of Dune 2. So you're talking in the span of 9 months. And the book is longer than that for sure. That's the thing.
Yeah, and, you know, we're still within the year 10991, aren't we? Because...
Yeah. Irulan quotes it in her journal.
That's right, she does. And at that point, I was thinking, hang on, we're still in the same year?
It's a busy year, right?
Yeah. And, you know, they were other characters, weren't they? What's the guy in the first film? Are they Mentats?
Yes. Peter DeVries, who, of course, was killed in the gas sequence.
Yeah.
But, Stephen McKinley Henderson's
That's
version
right.
of Two for Howitt. Yeah. Apparently, they did shoot some sequences with him. I think they probably did that as insurance, knowing full well they wouldn't be able to get him in here.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite parts of Dune, the book, is that Two for Howitt is essentially subsumed by the House Harkonnen. And he has to go to business as the House Mentat to replace Piter, who's killed in the first half of the book. And there's at the throne room sequence, there's another little twist of fate with Tufer Howitt that ends his arc. And I love it in the original, you know, Lynch shot it, and it doesn't appear in anything other than cut scenes, but it's a really great cut scene. And it hasn't ever showed up in anything other than like the Spice Diver cut. It would have been cool if he'd gotten Stephen McKinley Henderson. But, you know, like James Hancock likes to complain, Villeneuve really made the decision to pull up stakes from describing Mentats at all. He really wanted to talk about Bene Gesserit, and feature filmmaking only had room for like one of the special disciplines. Because, you know, we can talk about how we don't get spacing guild in this either, and that's one of my own personal pet peeves. So the Bene Gesserit really got the you know, at least he fleshed out what the Bene Gesserit were about, even if we lost out on Mentats.
Yeah, no, having not read the book, I've got a pretty, you know, scarce knowledge of the depth that the book goes into in relation to these other characters, these, you know, these other worlds, and obviously the spacing guild. But I think one thing that this film does lack is I wanted to see more of stuff going on other planets just to expand the scope of this big war that's coming.
Yeah.
I think setting all of it on Arrakis, pretty much, you know, obviously we see the Emperor's homeworld, we see, you know, the Harkonnen's homeworld, but I think the first film in a short period of time did more to establish the scale of the universe in this story, whereas I think the second film, the story focus, that was one of the things that got sacrificed.
Yeah, that's a fair thing to say. And, you know, if you ask me, the idea of minimizing the guild, the spacing guild, what it does is it shrinks down the toil of interstellar travel. The universe then becomes like Tatooine, the way Star Wars keeps winding back on this desert planet, as if there's nowhere else to go. And, you know, a galaxy filled with habitable worlds. But, you know, the idea of, like, not only do you have wonderful habitable worlds in the Dune books, there's also this element of how difficult it is and what a achievement mankind took to create engines to go between stars and then to develop the human mind as such, as a computational machine to navigate between those worlds. God, I mean, just me saying that makes it difficult to think, how could you have couched that cinematically? And maybe Villeneuve could have and chose not to, just for the sake of streamlining the narrative.
Yeah, and who knows where this is going to go. There may well be a third film further down the pipeline where these things are able to be explored. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure Villeneuve has got his reasons for telling the story that he's told. And again, I don't think I'm in the best position to be negatively judging him on that because I've not read the books. But I've got to say, in terms of the story he has told, as I've said, I was totally immersed in it. And I've, you know, from a technical point of view, this film is just, my jaw was on the floor throughout. Steve and I saw it. We saw it on a huge screen in Dolby Atmos, and we were silent throughout for the entire runtime of that film.
He strikes me as being one of these directors that shoots what he needs. What was it? Kurosawa was one of these guys who just picked up the angles he needed. He didn't do reverse coverage. He didn't do master shot, you know, all these things. It's like he went and picked up what was on the shot list for that day, knowing full well what the edit was going to be. And I get the impression Villeneuve was shooting for the edit along the way. And so he was able to do, him and Greg Fraser, the shooter on this movie, made the desert look great, made the sound stages look great in Budapest. Just about everything looked beautiful. And so there was just a real workmanlike attention paid to every frame, so that when they're shooting on that desert, you know, you get every single grain of sand adding to the brilliance of every frame.
Yeah, there was one particular shot where it was the ornithopters with the backdrop of obviously this huge desert landscape. And my eye was just totally tricked. I didn't think any of that shot looked anything other than real. There were none of the usual signs which tell, you know, my pretty well-trained brain that what I'm looking at is artificial. And several times in this film, I was just completely sucked in and forgot I was watching a special effects-laden film.
Yeah.
And then there was, as I said to Steve when we were having a chat about the film afterwards, there was one little shot in particular that I just thought was really shonky. And it was after Fade Rautha is kind of anointed. Looks very much like one of the Nuremberg scenes that you think of.
Yeah.
The kind of goose-stepping Nazi army. And it just looked, the black and white photography, or the photography that's later been converted into black and white, it looked off. And there was something about the contrast that just pulled me out of it for a second. I thought, I don't really like that. That doesn't look, the sort of verisimilitude and the convincing effects which have just sucked me in so far, have all of a sudden now, that little shot doesn't tie in with them. But that is just one minor little nitpick in a film that's craggy, nearly 2¾ hours long.
But that's funny, because I think we both, I didn't trip over, like you're saying, it's not the world's biggest offense. However, I noticed that both the crowds in the bleachers and the goose-stepping soldiers didn't have the strange fluidity of motion and the kind of randomness that the orc armies had, for instance, from all of, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. Whatever kind of, Weta software they designed to create randomness in the movements, so that when the crowd, the melee shots would have an organic nature to them, is that you're not just watching sprites exist in a right-angled plane where they just march forward. That scene had a little bit, it was a little underbaked, only because it didn't have enough messy randomness, especially the goose-stepping soldiers. It's maybe because they're goose-stepping in unison the way we know fascists and totalitarians to do. It kind of defeats the randomness. It defeats the sort of algorithms of making human-looking features by having them, in fact, march the way humans would march in a very algorithmically pure sense. It's hard to say, though. But I do agree with you on that one shot. That might be the only quote-unquote weak shot of the movie. And again, it's still more beautiful than, Smurfs 2.
Yeah, the Harkonnen plant, is that Giedi Prime?
Yeah, Giedi Prime.
Right. So Giedi Prime, Bill, they've established that they've got this black sun. Now, the self-taught astrophysicist inside me was grinding my teeth thinking, there is no such stellar phenomena as a black sun.
No, unless you're talking about Soundgarden's black hole sun from 1996. No, there's no such thing.
It didn't work for me. The fact that it was just everything was monochrome. I don't know.
I mean, it's I get, it was for the arena shot. We saw it in the trailers beforehand. I wonder, is this a stylistic thing? Is he going a little French New Wave? Is he trying to make this into a Godard movie like Day for Night? Le Nuit Americaine. And then it's like, oh, no, he's trying to kick in a little bit of sci-fi, as if to say there's a light source here that would be amenable to human life, but also chromatically would bleach everything. Because, inside, as we saw when they're in the cover, there's color. Margot Fenring's garments have a color, and you can actually see skin tone on Fade Rautha when he's prowling the hallways looking for her. So it's a little, I get it. It's more of a movie thing than a storytelling thing. And it's like, well, the story he's actually telling there is after the gladiator fight. It's when Margot Fenring winds up capturing Fade's seed.
Yeah.
He didn't shoot it in pure black and white. So what the hell?
I was going to ask you what things you don't like about the film, but maybe I'll phrase it differently, right? Do you think then that Villeneuve has made the best possible adaptation of Frank Herbert's book, given the resources available to him? And if not, what would you have done differently?
Man, that's a good question. And again, so let's say we have three different adaptations. We got the John Harrison miniseries, which I know the diehards will remember. There was two of those. And those, suffered from low budgets. And by the way, John Harrison still has a producer credit on this, because he must have done one of those Milnick or Uslan Batman deals where his name is just associated with the shit forever. So they'll be making this stuff in the year 3000, and John Harrison may still be on it just because he bought the rights to it. They tried to make it much more. I think they had something like 6 or 8 episodes in the 2000 miniseries to spread it out a little bit. And, it may have been more faithful to the story, but it was just shabby because it was all shot in Hungary or Bosnia, Skopje, or I don't know where the fuck they shot it. And David Lynch was able to make the movie, he essentially taxed this Mexican craftsman crew and all these photographers who came from the United Kingdom and some of these actors that came from America and, all the clean water that could possibly cram down these people's throats before they would get dysentery working in Mexico City. And Rafael de Laurentiis doing her best to just sort of pump as much money into this production as imaginable. It's great, but I guess it falls apart because he wasn't given final cut on it. And, what Denis Villeneuve had was every single asset at his disposal. But for me, the only thing I would take away as a kind of global thing is the climate of screenwriting in 2023. The idea that when people speak in Dune, they sound like teenagers from Reseda, California. Every time, I'm not taking anything away from Zendaya, but Zendaya speaks, she's like, oh, I'm not going over there. And, you wouldn't imagine, what's her name? The Welsh actress who played Helen Mohiam in the first, Sean Phillips.
Sean Phillips, yeah.
Sean Phillips, sorry. Yeah, I'm spacing here. Sean Phillips. The difference between getting actors like Patrick Stewart and Sean Phillips, and they create this world where they truly sound a lot like the book. It the dialogue and the screen, the complexion of screenwriting, the characteristics of the language sound more like Frank Herbert's book, and I think it thrives because of that. One of the things I love is how Dune 1984 sounds. This looks more like you'd want Dune 1984 to look, but everyone just speaks like, even Bardem as Stilgar is like reassuring Paul Atreides, you know, don't have to be brave. We all know that you are brave. Just do something very simple. And it's like, this is what like a soccer coach would say to his, you know, his charge before he goes out there to do like a free kick. You know, this isn't necessarily the grand stirring language of mid-century filmmaking. You know, what something would sound like from David Lean or from Palin Pressburger. I mean, it's hard for me to kick this movie in its side for anything like that. It's kind of a trivial thing, but I do listen to the way movies are written. So it's like, you know, your question was, what could Villeneuve have done differently, or what, you know, what would have made this a better movie? Simply the character of screenwriting, but I think that's like what we're left with is in this diseased day and age, is that you have to make sure that people are not able to distinguish this from the kind of language that you would hear inside of a TikTok video from an influencer. It has to sound colloquial in such a way that kind of debases language a little bit, but that's me being an old man shaking my fist at a cloud, you know?
Yeah, I don't envy the job that Villeneuve is doing here. He's adapting a book that is, like you say, 60 years old, has got a entrenched fan base, very passionate fan base, but also he's trying to make a film that's looking to appeal to as wide an audience as possible, and it is just a really tough balancing act, I guess. But, well, like we say, filmed on a reported budget then of $190 million, $25 million more than the budget of the first film, which went on to take a global box office haul of $433 million. My next question is, what do you think the global box office take will be for part two? What's your estimate as to how well this film will do?
Well, considering that, yeah, what's it going to leg out to? That's a really good question. You know, and I thought that a comp would be, and I may have talked about this with Jamie Hancock in the live stream, and, you know, he had real pie in the sky estimates for the opening weekend and maybe what the overall gross would be. And I think that if everybody's looking at Oppenheimer, which, what did it crap out at? $900 million? It almost got to a billion. It was just shy of $1 billion.
Yeah, just shy of a billion, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, of course it had this giant phenomenon, like you say, available, you know, at the same time to capitalize on. This can't get close to that, but it's a lot of the things. It's like, it tells you that if Oppenheimer had dropped alone without Barbenheimer phenomenon, it probably would have been the comp of this movie. Probably would have been the kind of thing. People would have recognized the quality of it, but it wouldn't have quite had the same spillover to get to close to a billion. So Jesus, man, I mean, I'll say that this is probably only going to creep in over about 100 million more than the original did. Which is still, you know, it's still incredible. I think it has more to do with the fact that you need a Barbenheimer-sized phenomenon to pull this thing into what they were probably thinking of in terms of like, oh, Oppenheimer, let's get Oppenheimer. However, at the same time, I'll hedge my bet by saying no other movie now or in the next 6 years is going to have Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Bardem, Austin Butler, Flo Pugh. I mean, there's just some – Aaliyah, here's the thing, is that between Florence Pugh and Chalamet and Zendaya – that's like, you know, 15% of all TikTok videos. That is an enormous quotient of what pushes this into people's brains beyond just making a movie with matinee idols. These are people for whom there's like a whole social fable already written out there. There's a tapestry, not unlike the Midsummer mosaic that's on the side of the cabin that Florence Pugh is looking at that tells the story before it's written already. This is one of the really smart things is, you know, whereas Oppenheimer had a great story, it stuck to its convictions, it had some great performances, but it was really based on inside baseball of you knowing who a guy like Cillian Murphy is. This movie comes at you with arguably the hottest stars in existence today. I don't know who you're missing besides Taylor Swift. If you'd cast Taylor Swift as the Baron Harkonnen, that's the only way you could have juiced this movie over the line more than what this already is, just based on star power alone. So I'll give it credit for that, but I'll say it only makes it about $100 million over the original.
We're 5 days into its global release now. It's already on $189 million, which is just shy of its actual budget. I think it could easily surpass $600-700 million, no problem. And I'm hoping that we might see some sort of disproportionate snowball effect and people could go back and back and see this film again and again, which I think they may well do. And I think it maybe would be quite savvy of Warner Brothers and Legendary. I know they re-released the first film prior to the release of this film, but I think if both films were released, you know, if the first film was released back into the cinema and people had the option of seeing them, not necessarily back to back, but going to see one film the one night and then the other one again, I'd certainly love to see the first film in IMAX on the big screen and then go and see the second one again. Because as much as I, not to play my sort of final verdict too early, as much as I love this film, it did make me want to rewatch the first film because there are aspects in this film missing from that film, which, you know, I was kind of yearning for. Like Oscar Isaac's character, which I know, you know, we feel his presence in this film, but
yeah,
having not read the book, I was thinking, is there any scope for Duncan Idaho to make an appearance in this film in a flashback or anything? I felt we didn't see enough of him in the first film. He was one of my favourite characters. I thought Jason Momoa was just born to play that character. And at one point in the film, I was actually harking for a little bit more Duncan Idaho, just to make his presence feel known, maybe a flashback or anything. I don't know how they could have worked that into the story, but there are certain things in the first film which are absent in the second, and that is why I think overall, this is the second part of one long 5 hour plus long film. I think that is the best way that I can sort of see this film, and hopefully further down the line on 4K and Blu-ray, Villeneuve is going to choose to maybe release just a complete version of this film and maybe sort of bulk it up with things that for whatever reason he saw fit to omit from both theatrical versions. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. Maybe he's just satisfied with both films as they are.
You know, we never got a Dune director's cut. There are deleted scenes. There's many deleted scenes of the first movie that are only fabled at. Like, we have production stills of the shooting of them, and I am dying to get a Lord of the Rings type expanded cut of each of these movies because I want to see every shred of edited film they put together for these things.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's why I would just like to see if these films can be stitched together, and just to give us this huge 5 hour epic, or maybe they just will work better as two individual films would fit together nicely and form this big cohesive whole. But going on to my next question, Bill, the first film bagged 6 Academy Awards, all for mostly technical categories. How do you think part 2 will fare come award season, and which categories do you think it will have most chance of winning?
I think that Chalamet could make his first punch into Best Actor, for sure. And I think everybody's been waiting for Chalamet to ascend to this role, his sort of heir to Leo DiCaprio as the preeminent leading man of his generation. You know, and DiCaprio had to wait a good long time before he won his Oscar. He was well into his early 40s by that point. And I think Chalamet's going to, you know, you could say he's done the work, you could say he hasn't done the work, but it's obvious that he's in a class among very few competitors. So I think Chalamet punching for Best Actor is a very real contingent. But on top of that, I think Rebecca Ferguson could very well be a runaway for Best Supporting Actress in Oscar. This is exactly the kind of thing like Davine Joy Randolph, who's probably going to win presumptively the Oscar this year. I think Rebecca Ferguson may be the one sure thing that comes out of this movie. She's so solid in it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like I said, I think Chalamet, Zendaya, Ferguson, Bardem, I think they're all in absolutely top form. Austin Butler is great.
Yeah.
But like I say, there were one or two little things about his performance I thought were just needed a little bit more refinement. I think in terms of technical prowess, this film has to win Best Special Effects, Best Visual Effects. They are just some of the best I've ever seen. The production design is phenomenal. I think the sound design is just magnificent. And the score, let's talk about the score, because it's rare that I'll actually listen to a film score before I see the film, but I did this.
Yeah.
I've done this with the last couple of Hans Zimmer films. In fact, the last couple of Villeneuve films. I think I actually listened to the score for Blade Runner 2049 before I saw the film. But yeah, I think Zimmer's score for the first film is just unbelievable. And I think he equals his work there in this second film. It just fits perfectly. There's no, you know, I can't think of any comparison to anything other than other scores I've heard in Villeneuve films and other scores by Hans Zimmer. It's well edited, and I think one thing I heard in an interview that Villeneuve said that he doesn't want to repeat the successes of the first film. He wants to learn from some of the mistakes, and one of the ones that he felt he could have done better is in terms of the editing. And as much as this is a longer film, I think it's a more tightly edited film. I don't think the pace is as languid, certainly as some of his previous films, certainly like Blade Runner 2049, which I think was definitely too slow paced, and I think far longer than it needed to be. But I think here, the film clipped along at such a pace that I was occasionally looking at my watch, not in so much as, you know, how long is left to go. I was thinking, my God, it feels like there's so much more story to tell. How long has he got left to tell it? Because he's cramming so much in. But yeah, I mean that in a positive way. I felt that I wasn't looking at my watch and thinking, yeah, you know, when is this going to end? I was thinking, I need this to go on longer because I don't want this to come to an abrupt end. Like I said, I think there were a few elements of the ending in terms of certain characters' deaths, as I've said, which were a little bit anticlimactic. But aside from that, I came away just absolutely buzzing. Myself and Steve were, and we had quite a lengthy debrief about the film in the car park afterwards.
So if you want to think of this movie, like, I think the way it was probably, if the way it was written is that this movie has it as such that it is the second 3-hour block of what may eventually wind up being close to a 9-hour story, considering it's only slightly longer than Dune Part 1.
Yeah.
And it leads into a Dune Messiah, Dune Part 3, which has a lot of story left to tell. But the nice thing is the world building of Dune 1 and Dune 2, I think, will allow Denis Villeneuve the ability to move at a faster clip. Considering that Dune Part 1 had the world building, Dune Part 2 had the swagger of being able to operate inside the confines of that world. And Dune Part 3, there's even a chance that it could wind up being the slickest, sharpest, and shortest of these three movies, because he will kind of concatenate Dune Messiah and Children of Dune most likely into one book. And he will find a way to slice through all the weird palace intrigue and the sort of inertia of a series of books that don't really have bad guys in them. I think he'll create bad guys and he'll make a large tapestry. And, you know, I think you can guess where Paul Atreides' story ends, as all these things do. It's not a good ending, but in a way it would be sort of a natural ending at the end of Dune 3. Hopefully you don't make Dune 4, which is a very weird movie, and I don't really have any faith in Hollywood studio filmmaking to make it. But, you know, like this almost, in fact, maybe a media res ending of Dune 2 that almost in a cliffhanger sets up Dune 3. And I guess they might have already greenlighted it, I forget. But I'm interested to see what comes next.
Well, yeah, that kind of answers my final question, Ed, because, you know, Villeneuve has shown now many times that he's got the chops for large-scale intelligent science fiction. And if further Dune films are to come and Villeneuve decides to stay with this, would you like to see just one more film to bring this story maybe to more of a final conclusion? Or would you like it to go on and to cover further books in the Dune saga?
No, I don't want it to go on beyond a third movie. You know, one of the things about Dune, the books 3 and books 4, is that they are very much books. They're creation. They're non-cinematic versions of this story. Again, James Hancock likes to point out again and again that Dune, the book, has the most cinematic sequences of all of them. But recently, there was a story about what David Lynch's treatment of his own version of Dune 2 would have entailed. He started work on a preliminary draft. And, you know, some things about that seem absolutely unhinged, completely bent, and cracked in terms of how he would have created a cinematic version for his own sake based on what Dune 1984 looked like. The sequel would have almost been more wild, more body horror. All the strange non-orthogonal features of Dune 1 would have been reflected in Dune 2. And there would have been a completely different set of villains that would have taken over from the Harkonnens. And I think that I trust Villeneuve and his... it was John Spates got credit for this one. And people said that Eric Roth got credit on screenwriting for Part 1, was not given credit on Part 2, although there's a good chance that Eric Roth did have something to do with it, but the guild ruled against putting his name on it. So who knows at this case? But I think that there's enough high-octane screenwriting in this team to kind of create a Dune 3 based on what I would assume the bad guys would be the face dancers, the Bene Tilaxu. And it's a conspiracy. What happens? They're trying to take over, trying to dethrone Paul. They're trying to essentially reverse the gains that they made in this movie through a lot of subtle stagecraft and things like that. And I'm really curious what that would turn into under their tutelage, under their guidance, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't think there's been any, you know, official word yet from Villeneuve as to whether or not the third film has been greenlit. Maybe, you know, legendary Warner Brothers are waiting to see how this film does. Imagine if that's it. Imagine if it ends here.
Think of how long it took. Remember how long it took them to greenlight part two based on how well? Yeah. Like, it was a ridiculous amount of time. It's like, come on, man, this is a sure thing. We know this is going to happen. And they fucking dragged their feet on it for a good long time.
Yeah, but again, you know, we weren't in normal times then. I don't think we've been in normal times ever since. But things, you know, certainly the landscape of cinema was, it was on very shaky ground at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I do understand why there might have been some reluctance to greenlight that second film. But it seems as soon as they did, you know, it was, I think Villeneuve, he's just gone all out. Well, let's just move then on to our final thoughts and our score out of 10 for Dune Part 2.
I'm a soft mark on this sort of thing. It took my money. It left me on the side of the street with a black eye, or I woke up in the tub with my kidney taken out, a bath filled with ice water. it gets me. This was 10 out of 10. You know, whatever I can say about it that's possibly, you know, a criticism just sort of winds up being part and parcel to something small. It's a mere bagatelle to ignore on the way to an incredible film night. I mean, how many times I sat there in the theater thinking, this is rousing, you know, classic filmmaking, cinematic film, action, heroic filmmaking. You know, this guy doesn't make that. This guy makes weird movies with Jake Gyllenhaal punching his doppelganger in the chin as a fucking spider strolls over Toronto. A giant spider strides over the skyline of Toronto. This guy doesn't make movies like this. He makes movies with Paul Dano trapped in a plywood shed that Hugh Jackman is keeping him prisoner. This is a completely different ballgame. And, you know, the fact is I just felt so goosebumpy over the course of this movie. It's like, yeah, man, more of this, whatever this is. Let's have as much of this as you can get, because I'm just on board with this version of it in 2024.
Yeah. Well, look, I've not read the book, and I would describe myself as an ever-increasing fan of the 84 film. As you know, my love of that film is growing.
Yes.
And I'm someone who, for the longest time, in fact, right up until 2021, just couldn't gel with the film. But it's got its teeth into me, and I am loving that film more every time I watch it. And as with the first film, I watched it again, and I enjoyed it a lot more the second time round. I'm not going to give part two a 10 just yet, because as Steve always says, there's nothing more important than that important second watch of a film. And there are little things about this film that they're going to prevent me from giving it a 10 outright so early on. I don't tend to give a film a 10 out of 10 on first viewing. Very rarely has that ever happened. But as much as I was absolutely blown away, I was just completely absorbed into this world. I thought from a technical point of view, it was just incredible. My jaw was just dropped, and I can't wait to see it again. I'd love to see it in IMAX. But I don't know if the film moved me emotionally as much as I wanted it to. And I don't know if that's down to me not having a connection with the story because I've not read the books. But it just didn't move me to the point where I came out an emotional wreck. Like I did with Fellowship of the Ring. Like I did with, you know, The Two Towers and Return of the King. And it's things like that that make it far more easier for me to give a film a full-throated, confident 10 out of 10. But that's not to say the score won't go up. But for now, and it's not going to affect our final score, because once I average it out, it's going to be rounded up. But for now, yes, for Villeneuve's Dune Part 2, I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. So that's a 9 from me, a 10 from you, Bill. That's a 9.5. Rounded up, that's a full 89 verdict for Dune Part 2 of 10 out of 10. Go and see it.
What did what was Steve Amos's number, by the way? Did he get his?
He didn't give it a number, but I think he pretty much echoed everything I said about it.
Right.
He thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, the fact that we were both completely silent throughout says a lot.
I think the Welsh Bluesman is a better read person than I am at the moment. I'm assuming he actually has read the book, too. Of all of us, he would be the most likely to have actually already taken the book down.
But do you know what? I think, actually, I'm sure he mentioned the other night, he's read it three times.
Look, I'm sure in our coterie, Matthias has not read it. Jacob has not read it. John, I'm sure, has read it. Our friend of the show, frequent contributor John Arminio. I don't think Neil has read it. I've read it. You have not, but Steve definitely has. Sure.
Yeah, three times. Yeah, mm-hmm. He is Film 89's resident bookworm.
Yep.
So there we go. Dune Part 2 done. Let's hope one day in the not too distant future we're talking about Dune Part 3.
Yeah, man.
Because I certainly want it.
Or Star Trek Part 3. I'll take that as a stopgap.
Yeah. Well, why not? Let's do that soon. So, Bill, thank you once again for joining me. And where can people hit you up on social media if they want to talk to you about spice, giant sandworms? We didn't even mention the fucking sandworms, Bill. What the hell? Right. Come on.
I know,
man. I think we covered that in the first, but yeah, you know, we saw more this time, didn't we?
Yeah. No, but in the best way too. And you know, just as a little curly cue, it's like Villeneuve invented his own, because it's not really described in the book, precisely how one writes a sandworm. It was left up to interpretation. But I love that David Lynch came up with one method, which involved his own version of the maker hook and latching onto the side and allowing the worm to roll over to get the affected part out of the sand as to avoid irritation. And I love the, you know, Villeneuve, of course, would think about this completely balls out, that you sit on top of a dune and then you essentially lure the Shai Hulud onto the dune itself. And so it collapses. So you stride the worm from on top as the dune subsides around it, which is just, again, it's great filmmaking. It's all done in close contact with, and probably on real sand for some of it. But it's just, he really thought about it. I appreciate both these directors hit the same topic from two different directions. But anyway, the question, your question was, where do you find me? I'm on social media. When social media works, indicating timestamping Facebook's and Instagram's outage today, long massacre on social media. I'm on Twitter at William Scurry. I'm on Insta. I'm on Facebook at either Bill or William Scurry. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/AMCaesar. You see my video stuff there, little make em ups, funny stuff. I got my own podcast too. I do a show on a weekly basis with my co-host Noah Tarnow called I Don't Get It, about pop culture issues, occasionally film, but it's mostly just a 40 or 48 minute foo-for-all about what people are talking about today, young popular culture amongst the kids. Yeah, so I'm out there in the world. Take a look.
Cool. And if, aside from listening to me here, you want to get hold of me on social media, you can reach me on Facebook and Twitter at Sky Movies. That's Sky with an E. And if you'd like to speak to Steve or Neil or anyone else from Film 89, you can hit us up at Film 89 UK on Twitter and Facebook. Or if you'd like to email us, it's admin@film89.co.uk. Please check out the website, film89.co.uk, where I think pretty soon Steve is going to be dropping his first part of a huge piece on 70s and 80s martial arts films. Really looking forward to that one. Ooh. And yeah, I think that's it, Bill. Until next time, stay safe, be excellent to one another, but more importantly,
stay spicy.